This is Jerry Pippin, and this is a special report. Politics and the media. How they work together, hand in hand. Former police reporter Jim Mars.
Well, let me give you another example of how that we've been blindsided here and have been kept in the dark. When I started my career as a newspaper reporter, as a police reporter, I would run with the cops. Sometimes I'd ride with the cops. Talk about your embedded journalist.
Right.
And I'd wear a trench coat and a little fedora hat, and I'd run right in there with them, and it was usually just me and my pencil and a notepad, and I'd go into crime scenes. I've been into the homicide scene, stepped over the bodies, the blood, suicides, plane crash. And then, again, over the course of my career, what happened was, the next thing you know, there's three or four or five radio reporters with tape recorders, and they're all wanting in. Well, they can't let everybody in. The next thing you know, there's TV crews. Once they got TV cameras that were mobile enough to be able to carry them around with you, now they're there. They want in. They got a light guy and a sound guy, and pretty soon there's 25, 30 people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they can't allow them to go tromping around in a crime scene, so they had to keep everybody out. Before long, they had that damn yellow tape, you know, and they
Right. Pushed
it around everything, kept you off. And now that tape, they push you back 12, 14 blocks, in the case of Waco, 2 miles, and nobody can see what's going on. And when you get that kind of situation, like on normal circumstances, let's say there's a barroom shooting. Okay, so the reporter waits down the block until the police spokesman comes and says, okay, we got one person killed, his name was blah, 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 and gives the facts. And in that situation, you're probably okay. But when it gets to something of the magnitude and political, then that's just not any good, because they can come out and from behind the yellow tape and tell us any cover story they want to. And unless we're allowed to examine the evidence for ourselves, how are we going to be able to know whether that's right or wrong?
I've really wanted to do a show on how the press, the media, and politicians work together hand in hand, sometimes not even knowing how they scratch each other's back. We have invited Mike Miller to join us. Mike is a longtime personal friend. He's a TV anchor of some renown in Little Rock and also Tulsa. Was a TV reporter in Washington, D.C. for several years. Became involved in politics, as always, because he was an anchor and also a reporter. And politics was his beat. In addition, Mike decided that maybe he should go over to the other side of the fence. In other words, go to the political side and work as a press secretary, handling press relations. So he's the perfect guy to present, and he has a book out that I recommend highly. It's an autobiography of his work as a TV anchor, and also as a political person, mainly as a press secretary for some major Republican politicians. The name of the book is How High Can I Stoop? It's available on Amazon and a few other places as well, and we have links to it from the Mike Miller page on our website. First of all, Mike, since we last talked, you've moved to Florida.
Yeah, finally retired down here where all the retirees are, trying to keep busy and finding that after an interesting life, a career in radio and TV and politics, life is rather dull.
Bored, Mike Miller, maybe you need to write another book.
I don't know. That was the hardest thing I think I've ever done. It took months, and then I'd have really been lost without a computer. When I started writing it, there weren't computers, and fortunately I made a lot of notes along the way, which was very helpful, but without spell check and all the other stuff and the internet and being able to research things and confirm things and spellings and all that, it would have been impossible with a typewriter.
And, Mike, you know, it's funny how quickly we take things for granted. I mean, I don't know how we did it without computers. I mean, we had stacks of paper everywhere, typing on the old typewriter constantly.
I could have had a passing grade in school if I'd had a computer.
Where did you go to school? Tulsa?
Yeah, I went to Catholic school, Marquette, and then 4 years at University of Tulsa. Studied radio TV production, worked on KWGS, the old FM station.
It's still there. It's still cooking.
Right. It was the first FM, I think, at least one of the first ones in Tulsa.
No, I think you're right about that.
Yeah. It was a good place to make your initial mistakes.
Now, you worked at all three television stations, I think, in Tulsa as an anchor.
Yes. I may be the only one who's ever anchored the news on all three of the major affiliates.
Yeah, it'd be a little more difficult now. Everybody wants a non-compete clause, exclusivity, stuff like that.
And the only way you could ever get a raise
is
to leave, yeah. I mean, contracts, I don't know if they have contracts or unions. I doubt it. But they didn't have contracts or unions. In fact, if you mentioned the word union, you were probably out the door real quick.
Now, your dad was a local celebrity in Tulsa, if I remember correctly.
Correct.
He had a dance studio?
Yeah, for those familiar with Tulsa, East 15th Street had a row of dance schools, and Lou Miller Dance Studio, he started that, oh gosh, must have been in the late 30s, early 40s, and he taught so many people, so many kids, and they grew up and had kids. And he taught them, and they grew up and had kids, and he taught them. When I would walk around with him in downtown Tulsa or someplace, people would come up to him on the street. Yeah, everybody knew him. And I could not believe how many people knew him from the dancing school.
Well, Mike, I remember him well. He was quite the Mr. Showbiz in Tulsa.
He was a theatrical booking agent. He and Sam Avey. They started Hey Rube. It was an organization back in, during World War II that entertained the troops. And they had, Joe Lindy's band. They borrowed a bus from one of the bands in Tulsa. And they had the singers. One of the singers was Patti Page, worked for $5 a show. They had a comedian, magician, a line of girls.
Yeah, Mike, we have a link over to an interview we did with you some time back in which we talked about the entertainment business in Tulsa, Oklahoma, of all places, and your career in television there. But tonight I thought we would flesh that out a little bit and expand it. And talk about, your TV career. I mean, you ended up in Washington, D.C.
That's the place to be. That's like the major leagues, I think.
And then, later, you became a political consultant.
Well, you know, after 20 years in the news media, being fired numerous times and hired numerous times, I decided to get into something more stable, like politics. And I was happened to be in Little Rock at the time. The guy I was working for there at Channel 11 was just one of the meanest people I've ever met and worked for. He had a terrible temper, and I knew my days were numbered, so I started looking around before the axe fell and hooked up with Ed Bethune, who was running for Congress. And I became his press secretary. Ed was 50 points behind his Democratic opponent on the 4th of July when I went to work for him. And we pulled it off. It was quite an upset. He was the first Republican in that seat. That's the old Wilbur Mills Little Rock district.
Mm-hmm.
In 103 years. So it was quite an accomplishment.
Wow. Mike Miller, Mr. Magic Man. How did you do that? How did you get that much of a gain? How did Ed pick up that many votes?
Well, Bethune, number one, was one of the smartest people I've ever worked for. I was toying. I was also being interviewed, but Bill Clinton was elected governor. He was going to be governor. He hadn't been sworn in yet.
Yeah, he had been attorney general in Arkansas.
I didn't know which one to work for. I was non-political at this point. I just kind of vote for the band, you know. And growing up in Tulsa, when I was old enough to vote, registered Democrat because you could vote in primaries. If you were a Republican, they never had any primary opposition, so you never got to, you know, voice your choices. But anyway,
things have changed.
Yeah, I had actually met with Clinton. We had a bar, we had a couple of drinks, and he said, I could use you after I'm elected governor, but not until then. He was going to have, he said, about 5 media people on his staff, and I had a feeling that he had higher political ambitions than just to be governor of Arkansas. But anyway, I needed something immediately, so as I say, on the 4th of July, I went to work with for Ed Bethune as his press secretary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what happened was we caught our opponent flip-flopping a lot. He would tailor his remarks to different groups. You know, he'd be for abortion at one group and then like pro-life at another group. And, you know, he would, on about 5 or 6 different issues, we actually got him on tape flip-flopping and played him both all the flip-flops for the media. And that put him on the defensive, and he didn't want to debate because, as he announced one time, in a debate you'd have to take a position on a bunch of issues and I'd make you mad and you wouldn't vote for me. Fortunately, I had my tape recorder going, and we used that little comment in a radio commercial in the last week of the campaign, and it blew him out of the water.
So now you're back on your way to Washington, D.C., and this time as press secretary for a congressman.
Well, I stayed with him for this first term, and then he was his press secretary. He took me to Washington. That was my second trip to Washington. And then we had a falling out, or I had a falling out with his chief of staff, his administrative assistant. When during the campaign, I'd worked directly with Ed. You know, a press secretary should work with the member of Congress directly. They shouldn't have to go through somebody else. And that was very unwieldy. And so we clashed, and I left, and I went to work for the senatorial committee for 2 years.
And what did you do there?
I was the deputy director of communications, and because of my media background, they made me a media troubleshooter. And they'd send me into various campaigns, and I'd assist their media operation. And most of them were really poor, so it was easy to make a lot of recommendations. Some of them didn't even have a press list or a media list to send out press releases. And the press releases they sent out were an embarrassment with a lot of mistakes,
mm-hmm.
errors.
You know, Mike, that's really one of the things that stands out about changing nature of politics. It's the fact that press secretaries weren't all that important back in those days to many of the candidates.
Much higher.
Kind of an afterthought. But now that's a key person. I guess image is everything now.
So one of the places that I ended up, and they, as we got close to the, as the campaigns heated up closer to the election, we sent people out into every campaign that had a chance, and they sent me to Nevada, and I hooked up with a guy named Chick Hecht, who was a long shot there.
Mike, actually, that turned out to be a pretty good job for you. I mean, you had a lot of perks here in Las Vegas. Got to go out there a lot. In fact, we talked about that a lot when we did our live shows.
Ted Binion case.
You know, it was another long shot. You're building quite a reputation here.
Oh, wow. He was running against Howard Cannon. I don't know if that name rings a bell.
Oh, sure. I know. I remember Howard Cannon. He owned Las Vegas, owned Nevada.
But he was a long-time Senate.
Couldn't be beat.
Fixture there. And I think he got kind of dusted up by the Teamsters Union scandals that were going on. I don't think he got directly involved, but he was close enough to hurt him politically a little bit. And it was an interesting thing about that race is that Paul Laxalt was the senior senator, or he, I guess he was a junior senator at that time, and but very close to Chick, because Chick had been in the legislature. That's his only previous experience, political experience. Laxalt had been governor, and they were close. Laxalt said, on election eve, he said, they're going to try to steal it from you. He ran against Cannon before, and I think Cannon beat him by something like 4 votes. It was unbelievable. But there was a lot of shenanigans that he warned us about, so Chick sent me out to these, like, 8 precincts that Laxalt said were going to be shenanigans going on, and my jaw dropped when I saw what was going on, that these same people were voting at these different precincts. I mean, a big fat woman with a flowered dress and a big hat, you know, you'd see her at one, then you'd go to another precinct and she'd vote there, and then go to another precinct and she'd vote there. And people would take voters into the voting booth. They didn't have to show anything. And then they would point to where they were supposed to vote. You know, and then he came around and congratulated everybody. It was kind of bad. Anyway, we pulled it off, and Chick took me to Washington. Well, I just stayed in Washington, but when at least I had a job, and the senatorial committee, those are just temporary jobs. They change when a new director comes in. So I was happy to work for him, and work for him for his entire.
So how long were you with Chick Heck?
6 years, and a little more considering the, if you took into account the...
So now Mike Miller is press secretary again, but this time for a senator.
Right. And the thing about it is, what really beat him, well, the several things, I think. Number one, a very popular governor ran against him. And the thing about it is, he was weakened, I think. Number one, he'd made some gaffes. His biggest gaffe was he referred, you know, you're familiar with the nuclear repository.
Yes, uh-huh.
Put in Yucca Mountain, Nevada. Very unpopular. But Chick once, in an interview in a Reno TV station, referred to it as the nuclear suppository. And none of us even caught it at the time. Of course, it was replayed on all kinds of TV shows. And then featured, among other gaffes, he allegedly, some he had said, some he hadn't. The Wall Street Journal ran a front page story that just, it was devastating. And that hurt. And so anyway, he lost. And it was a close race. So I went to back, I was out of a job when he was out of a job. I wanted to mention one thing about Chick before we leave him. He was eating in the senator's dining room. You may have read this. And he choked on a piece of meat. And Senator John Kerry was sitting next to him, and put him in the Heimlich maneuver and saved his life. And then Chick died a few years ago. And John Kerry spoke at his funeral.
That points out one thing that's really changed, really, Mike, and that's the camaraderie of the Senate, and actually even both the House as well. Today they're liable to, you know, some member of the other party is choking, they're liable to let him do it. I may be exaggerating a little, but it's no longer a place where people get along.
People were much more cordial. And this was in the 80s when I worked on the Hill last, and they would socialize after work, go out and have drinks or dinner. It didn't matter. Even our next-door neighbor in the next office was a guy named Mitch Daniels. He was working for Senator Lugar from Indiana. He was just a staffer. Now he's governor of the state. But we were all socializing with, of course, he was a Republican, but when I was working for Bethune, our next door neighbor was Ozzie Myers, who got caught up in the Abscam scandal.
Yeah, I remember that.
Taking kickbacks. He was a Democrat. He was a wild man. And a lot of drinking and partying going on. But anyway, after Chick, I had to get a job, so I got a freelance job at the local TV station up there, Channel 9, which was a CBS affiliate, WUSA, and as a news writer, terrible pay. And the unions did not treat freelance news writers with any respect at all. So I had a call from a friend of mine that I used to work with at the senatorial committee who said, I play tennis with a guy that can use a press secretary and that he's not a mental giant by any means. And his name is Jim Inhofe. He was a congressman at the time. And I had interviewed Inhofe when he was in the Oklahoma legislature. I'd remembered him.
Yeah, he was also mayor at one time.
He was mayor of Tulsa, although I wasn't there at the time. I knew he was a pilot. I saw a picture of him flying a biplane over Tulsa and waving.
Yeah, I don't know how good of a pilot he is. He's had, I think, 3 plane crashes, maybe 4.
Yeah, I don't know how good a pilot he is. But I knew that he was so right-wing that he probably flew in circles.
Mike Miller, I love that joke, especially coming from you since you're a Republican.
Well, you know, I guess I've been a Republican now for quite a while, since the 70s, but I'm more of a pragmatic Republican, for one. I'm not wedded to all these Tea Party ideas of my way or the highway, don't compromise, and all that stuff. I think it's...
Well, I think you can figure out where this show's going. We're going to reveal lots of information about the press and its relationship with politicians. Coming up on the next part of our show, we're going to deal with Senator James Inhofe and a few others, revealing what they do know and what they don't know. The American political circus, has it been captured by those who not only don't care about issues, but don't care to be informed? It appears that students in America are not the only ones that have been dumbed down. This is Politics in the Press. I'm Jerry Pippin. We have been on the Internet now for a little over a decade, and we've watched Internet radio grow from a novelty to a commonly used tool by people on their computers. Internet users now routinely listen to shows while they are on the computer, either for business or for leisure. And then we have the podcast function. Many listeners, thousands actually, routinely download our shows and listen to them while driving, walking around, or just away from their computers in general. So advertising on the Internet is the logical way to reach listeners who will be open to your message. And we think we're the cream of the crop when it comes to Internet programming. We offer the lowest cost per thousand and the largest reach in listeners at that cost. Contact us for advertising rates and information. Simply email me at jerry@jerrypippin.com. Welcome back to our series, The Media and Politics. Are they an unholy alliance, or are they just working for the same goals, scratching each other's backs? What exactly is going on? We thought we would talk to Mike Miller. He has a big background in both the media and politics. Mike was a TV anchor and even worked as a Washington reporter for a Washington television station in D.C. Plus, he worked for 3 Republican office holders, 2 congressmen and 1 senator. They were all very conservative. Mike Miller, however, might surprise you with his views. First, we're going to talk about James Inhofe, the senator from Oklahoma, who made the statement one time, the way to get reelected in Oklahoma is to run on guns, butter, and God.
Senator Inhofe, you have called the threat of catastrophic global warming, quote, the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. and that man-induced global warming is an article of religious faith.
I actually believe that man-made gases caused global warming back when I was first the chairman of the Senate Environment Public Works Committee, until we found out what it would cost us if we conformed with Kyoto. We were getting ready to sign Kyoto at that time, and it was between $300 and $330 billion a year. And so we thought, let's at least look at the science and see that it's there. And I can tell you right now that the scientists that were very strongly for it at first are not now. And you haven't heard much about it recently. We're not now. You know, God's still up there. We're now going through a cooling spell. And the whole issue there was, is it man-made gases, anthropogenic gases, CO2, methane? I don't think so.
We're talking with Mike Miller on the line from Florida. Mike, Jim Unhoff is a very, he says he's a religious guy. And at one time he basically said, you know, whatever God's will is what will be done. And, of course, that appeals to a lot of people. He's pretty conservative, but you've worked for a lot of conservatives.
Yeah. Well, I found Unhoff to be very, very, the most conservative member I'd worked for. Ed Bethune was a pragmatic conservative, kind of like, I think, the way I am. Chick Heck was a hard-working Jesse Helms clone.
Well, a lot of people probably don't remember him, but I spent some time in Nevada. He was pretty right-wing.
Most conservative member of Congress. He used to refer to Jesse Helms as his liberal friend.
Jesse Helms.
Yeah. And but to me, Inhofe appeared to be more of a middle-of-the-road fascist. Anyway, this guy said he's not a deep thinker and you can help him, and he recommended me to him, and I got the job as his...
Mike, you're not the first person said that about Senator Inhofe, that he's not a deep thinker. You're being kind. But he seems to be successful. He's been there for some time.
Well, I don't know. You know, he... I don't know how he gets along. I know that some of his fellow House members at the time, I don't know how well they get along, because he walked into the office one day and he said, I just rode up the elevator with Barney Frank and I told him, you know, I've never met a real queer before. And, you know, Inhofe didn't reveal that Barney took a swing at him, but he added, I sure hope I didn't catch AIDS riding in that elevator with him.
And Inhofe was serious?
Oh, yeah. This is... AIDS was first reported back in 1981, 10 years earlier. By 1991, most people were well aware that AIDS wasn't spread by casual contact, you know, riding in an elevator. Anyway, that's my account of Barney Frank's comments, and then they were made in front of the entire staff, were included in a lengthy profile on Inhofe in February 2008 in an issue of the Oklahoma Gazette. Now, that's a publication you may not be familiar with, because I think it's only available around Oklahoma City.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Have you? Okay.
Yeah, I used to live in Oklahoma City. I used to be on the radio.
The profile on him, something about a mountain. You know, the M in James M. Inhofe. Do you know what the M stands for?
No.
Mountain. I'd say it should be molehill, but anyway, they quoted me what I just said to you about the Barney Frank thing,
mm-hmm.
And then. This was right in the heat of his campaign, and his campaign spokesman issued a response to my quote that was also published in this same article, and it said, well, it's been nearly 20 years since his short stint with the senator's office. He meant congressman, I guess. Mr. Miller's comments seem to be nothing more than the unfiltered remarks of a disgruntled former employee. And Inhofe said in a recent interview that the AIDS subject wasn't something that had he had done any research on at the time. He never denied any of it. And then another example of his mental capacity or incapacity was stands out in my memory. One day the House was voting on an appropriations bill that contained a project that was eagerly sought by the Tulsa Office of the Army Corps of Engineers, and his legislative staff told him in very clear language, "Jim, you need to vote for this. You have to vote yes on this appropriations bill." Well, when he returned from the House floor, Inhofe was quizzed whether he voted for in favor of the Tulsa project that was so important. And he said, "I voted no." "And why?" everyone asked at once. Inhofe just shrugged his shoulders, closed the door to his office, and we were all just stood around with our mouths open. He tended to do very unexpected things, even though, you know, you knew where he stood philosophically. It was very strange working for him. I got the feeling that, number one, he wouldn't take advice. It was very difficult to work for him as press secretary. When I joined his staff, he was taking off for Kuwait on a fact-finding congressional junket following Operation Desert Storm. Remember that?
Yes.
And I suggested that he invite Kuwaiti officials to conduct a How to Do Business with Kuwait seminar in Tulsa and, get some publicity over that. Inhofe didn't follow up on any of that. And I also advised him to position himself next to prominent celebrity newsmakers. At least he'd appear in some news footage, but he didn't even do that. I detailed in memos outlining an extensive media plan, all kinds of things for him, to raise his profile and improve his image, because he was getting some really bad editorials in the Tulsa papers at the time. And I said, to find an area of need, introduce some legislation. And since he liked to fly, I thought maybe, he ought to do something related to aeronautics. He could become an expert on aviation on Capitol Hill and use that position to promote the aerospace industry in Tulsa. He ignored that. He was absorbed. Flying was the only thing he was interested in that I could see. And
he seems to like his job. He keeps running for re-election and getting re-elected.
Yeah, I don't think he's ever held a real job and worked. You know, he's always been elected office.
Well, he did have that insurance company there in Tulsa in the Phil Tower building. He and his family ended up suing his brother over it, and I think the thing went bankrupt finally.
But, when shortly after I arrived, and I was only there for 6 months, but he announced that he wanted to pilot a Cessna 414 around the world, retracing the 1931 flight of Oklahoma aviator Wiley Post.
Oh, Wiley Post, okay.
Remember that?
Yeah.
You probably don't remember the flight, original flight, but it was in a plane named the Winnie Mae. Well, I talked to Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum into allowing Inhofe to hold a news conference to announce his flight right in front of Post's original Winnie Mae. It was there in the museum. And I thought, the event added some stature and authenticity to this, what was essentially a publicity stunt. The museum officials also allowed me to tell reporters that the trip was under the auspices of the Air and Space Museum. I remember this one Smithsonian official who earlier said no deal on co-sponsoring this gimmick. He asked me what auspices meant. I said, absolutely nothing. It just looks good in print. And right after, before he left on his round the world trip, here's another example, I think, of Inhofe and his mindset. Staff advised him to get a visa because he was planning to land in Moscow and that one would be required. Inhofe vetoed that idea, saying, "Hey, I'm a congressman, I won't need a visa. I'm important. I'm an important person." And then when he landed in Moscow without the visa, he was immediately placed under house arrest. And it took 3 days, I think, for the American embassy to get him free so he could resume his flight. Of course, the media was calling me every day for a report on how things were going on his round-the-world trip. And when Inhofe was arrested, I decided that I just would go home and not take any calls. I didn't want to lie to any reporters. You know, a good press secretary may not tell a reporter everything he knows, but he sure shouldn't lie. That can be disastrous.
Yeah, once you're caught.
Yep, caught in a lie, you can't. There, when I was at the senatorial committee, lies would blow candidates right out of the water. They'd lie about their, oh, I was a war hero in Vietnam, you know, and then the reporter would check and find out he'd never even served in the military. And that would be the end of that candidate. So you don't lie, but then anyway, he...
Well, Mike Miller, you've given me some information I didn't know about Senator Inhofe. He spent some time under Soviet arrest.
Well, it was hushed up. I mean, I hushed it up. I didn't hush it up. I just didn't...
Report it. Yeah.
But... He went on vacation for a month when he got back, supplying ammunition to those cynics who complain of Capitol Hill's all play and no work policy. And when he got back, I got a phone call from his administrative assistant in Tulsa, a guy named Bruce Thompson. He said, things just aren't working out, Mike. Jim wants you to clear out your desk and leave the office before he returns tomorrow. I was really dumbfounded. Usually a firing follows some warning. You know, you get an email or something, mm-hmm. You know, a memo. I hadn't received anything like that, and he'd gotten great press on his round-the-world trip. But I really suspected that he refused to follow any kind of strategy that might require additional effort, hold hearings or introduce legislation. Unlike the other members of Congress I work for, Inhofe apparently felt that there was absolutely no need to continue his congressional duties once he'd returned home, you know, like on weekends. Most members would visit with constituents to seek their views, sometimes try to resolve problems. They hold town hall meetings, news conferences when they go back to their district. Lawmakers tour new federal projects or areas in need of help from the federal government. But from what I observed, Inhofe preferred to relax away from Washington. The key word there is relax.
I understand.
And when Congress recessed most weekends, Inhofe would usually head right for his Grand Lake retreat, seldom making it into the Tulsa office. And at the lake, if he worked on anything at all, it was probably his tan. I thought he was one of the laziest congressmen I've ever seen. I hate to say that, but it's...
You know, Mike, when we talk about James Inhofe, I keep marveling at how he always gets reelected. Over and over and over.
I don't know. The thing about it is, he's a conservative in a fairly conservative state.
Well, Oklahoma is the reddest of the red states, at least according to the last presidential election. And just like that Soviet jail incident, he probably could have used that to his advantage. The Ruskies arrested me.
You know, there are a lot of people in Oklahoma that are part of that constituency that can identify him. With, you know, it's an evangelical,
yes,
streak he's got in him that my guess is that his opponents didn't have. So that got him a...
Well, you worked with him and for him. I mean, is that religion bona fide? I mean, is he religious?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Very much so.
Well, at least he's not a hypocrite.
No, he is religious. But he also religiously would, you know, relax up at Grand Lake instead of doing some work around the district. My guess is that these are things that most people
And most Oklahoma voters weren't aware
of
it.
Well, what goes around comes around, or at least a David on Inhofe. I mean, he hangs out at that lake, and he got a bacteria up there, a pollution. And, you know, he's been fighting against pollution, not against having pollution, but trying to control pollution. And he's been sick, got real sick.
In his last campaign, some people tried to promote my book with the section I had on Inhofe, which is kind of the stuff we've been talking about. I had a chapter in the book called Earth to Congressman Inhofe, and I think they thought that by promoting the book, people would find out about the real Inhofe and vote against him if it got a wide enough circulation. Well, number one, it didn't get a wide enough circulation. And the big mistake I think they made is trying to promote it among liberals. It should have been promoted among conservatives. Liberals weren't going to vote for him anyway. Conservatives are the ones who needed to be enlightened about Inhofe. And I think that was a mistake we had made. He was always coming in the office talking about Tom DeLay, my friend Tom DeLay. He's my buddy, Tom DeLay. So, I don't know, maybe your friends influence you a little bit. I think DeLay was also had that religious streak in him.
They all seem to be members of the family, you know, that religious cult, or at least I think it's a cult. Lots of congressmen, lots of senators belong to it.
Their rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that part of it, I don't think they're hypocritical. But some of the mistakes he made were just stupid mistakes. They weren't really philosophical mistakes. I mean, he's a conservative. There's no question about it. But do you want a good conservative or a bad one? I just think he's a bad one. And, you know, he can say that this is sour grapes from a disgruntled employee, and, yeah, sure. But that doesn't change the fact that he's exactly the way I describe
him. Mike, you know, this is part of a series we're doing on politics and the media. Why don't you explain to people, since you've been a press secretary at least three times, and then you were with the senatorial committee, the Republican senatorial committee, so you have plenty of experience on that side of the fence. Tell people what a press secretary does. We know he puts out fires.
Oh, yeah. Well, number one, I think the first thing they do, a press secretary, is that they're the spokesman for the office. And if a lot of times a member of Congress will want to issue a statement or a press release, and you are in charge of that, so you either read the statement or you tell an inquiring member of the news media the member's position on issues or whatever he's trying to get across that day. You have to be able to write press releases, and then you also you're responsible for generating media coverage, which includes not only press releases but photo ops, radio programs. The Hill has all kinds of media facilities to help press secretaries do their job in both parties, and each party has their own. But you can videotape reaction to something. For example, if you wanted to say something about the debt crisis, you could go to the TV studio and record something and tape a 30 or 40 second sound bite of your reaction, and then they would satellite it out to the TV stations in your state. And believe it or not, they would run these things about 90% of the time. And you do the same thing with radio stations, just easier to do. You could tape either sound bites or a radio program, and they would feed it out to all the radio stations in your district or state, and they would do all the work. You also do newsletters. Yeah, you'd have to write their newsletters. Sometimes you'd write their speeches. Ed Bethune didn't use
He never used a written speech. He just went from notes. But everybody else, I think, used a printed speech. So you'd have to be able to write speeches. That's the kind of thing you do all
yeah.
day.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the media. We've talked about politics and politicians. You're qualified to talk about the media. You were in it for a long time. A television anchor and a reporter, what, in Tulsa, Little Rock, Washington, D.C.? I think down in Dallas, Fort Worth, too, right?
Oh, yeah, I was in Dallas for a while. WFAA, it's a big station.
Yes, it is.
I had gone from Channel 8 in Tulsa to Channel 8 in Dallas, and it was kind of a shock. We had about 20 employees in Tulsa and about 90 in Dallas. Anyway, Marty Haig was the news director, and he hired me on the recommendation of a guy who'd been our station manager without even seeing me. And he had just taken over, and he put in a new system where you had a beat. All the reporters had a beat. Mine was the police beat.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good in a way because you usually led the news with the latest murder or armed robbery,
right,
bank robbery.
If it leads, it bleeds.
Right. And it sure did in Dallas.
Or it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah. And I did a five-part series on prostitution that I thought was really good. We borrowed a camera lens that could shoot in the dark, total darkness. You know, you get that green tint, but you could shoot prostitutes from a block away with a telescopic lens, and then we used wireless microphones, and some of the vice squads were very cooperative. Got into a van, an unmarked van, and then they had a plainclothes cop in a Cadillac convertible with the top down, and he would talk to these prostitutes, negotiate with them, and we'd film from the van and pick up his audio with the wireless mic. I remember at one point when we left the police station in this van, the first thing they do, I mean, these guys were kind of wild. First thing they do is go to a liquor store and buy a couple of cases of beer, and everybody started drinking in the van. And I remember my audio man at one point said, you know, I'm not picking the cop up in the convertible. And he said, my antenna, I'm not, you know, I need to get my antenna outside this van. And this cop said, oh, no problem. So he pulled out his gun and shot a hole in the roof. And, I mean, without batting an eye. I mean, just bang.
Now, it's been a long time since I've done police reporting. And it's been in small markets. But like Muskogee, my hometown. But it was pretty obvious to me right off the bat, the best way to get the stories become buddy-buddy with the cops, you know.
Afterwards, you know, when we were trying to do this story, the lawyers got involved, and they say you've got to have more white prostitutes. You're not, the girls on the street were mostly black, and then Dallas was having a lot of racial problems at the time. And they did not want to run a piece implying that all the prostitutes were black, because they weren't. But the problem was the white prostitutes were mostly call girls, and they were working the conventions,
mm-hmm.
in the hotels.
Yeah.
But I explained all this to the vice squad, and they said, well, we'll get you an interview with a white prostitute. And they drove out in a nice residential area, knocked on this girl's door. She opened the door, and it was quite a shock that her first John of the day was John Law. You know, they said, hey, you're going to do an interview with Mike Miller, and whether you like it or not, and so she did. So she said that the best customers, her best customers, were used car dealers and Baptists. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what she said.
It's a good soundbite.
Oh, yeah. But then the lawyers really got nervous. They ended up just letting me run one segment instead of five. And I leaked the whole problem to the
radio TV columnist in the Dallas Morning News, which is owned by the same company, Belo, and he ran a piece on it the next day about how they had suppressed four episodes.
Did you run across that a lot, Mike? I did. Basically, censorship because of business reasons, commercial reasons, or maybe legal fears.
Reasons.
Yeah, a couple of times. I remember one time I shot some film of somebody. I think it was Cleo Epps, the queen of the bootleggers.
Here in Oklahoma.
Who was appearing in the Tulsa Federal Building, and I was trying to get a shot of her. She got into the building before I could really get a good shot of her, so I ran into the building and got a shot of her inside the building, which was a no-no, and the judge held me in contempt, and our KOTV, I was working at Channel 6, Tulsa, and their lawyers had, and we all went with the judge in his chambers, and I think they prohibited that film from being run. But it's unusual. It doesn't happen too much. You know what would happen in the early days, though, a lot, is the sales department would get involved. And then, oh, you're not going to run this story. You know, they're a client.
Now, that's more of what I was faced with a lot.
Yeah, that's you run across that a lot, or I did. And or it would be just the opposite.
It's just, they want a plug. You plug them on the news, something pleasant, they may buy some advertising.
Do a story on Fred Jones Ford. We're trying to get them.
Yeah.
You know. I remember one time, I think it was a KOTV, and the sales department was trying to land a bank. I can't remember which bank it was, but they wanted me to stand in front of the bank and interview people on the street, asking them to name their three favorite banks, and I was right in front of the bank they were trying to get advertising from. Not one of them ever mentioned the bank I was standing in front of.
Oh, really?
Not one.
I think they needed some advertising. I mean, if you're standing right in front of the bank and the subject is your favorite bank, you would think you'd run across somebody at least that had been in there.
That was the idea, that they could sell to this bank. Look, people staying right in front of your bank don't even know you're there.
Yeah.
And so we had to do that a few times. But, you know, things were a lot different in what I like to refer to as the golden age of TV. You know, it was before color, before tape recording, VCR, before...
Today's photojournalism's a piece of cake. Back then, you had all that heavy equipment. It was a logistical nightmare just getting the film back and getting it developed in time for the news.
Oh, yeah. I remember at Channel 2, my first job in TV, a lot of times the film, you'd be running it through the processor, and maybe it would come through, but then it had to go through what they call a dry box, where it would dry off the chemicals. And if the film would break or something would happen to the processor, you get the film out, but it was all soaking wet. And so you would run down the hall.
Yeah, I think they had those big fans in the hall sometime.
But a lot of times we'd run down the hall with this film trailing, you know, like half a block behind you. And I remember one time Harold Stewart, the owner of Channel 2 at the time, was showing some clients through, you know, and here I am running down the hall as fast as I can, trailing film behind me. I'm sure that made a great impression. But, you had to, also, the equipment was so huge.
Yeah, it was bulky.
Very bulky. You had these cameras that weighed about 150 pounds, but were portable because they had a handle attached somewhere. And the audio was had to be processed along. It was on the side of the film. It was...
It was a soundtrack.
Yeah, soundtrack. And if you had a processing problem, it also affected your
audio.
And
if you didn't cut it just right, that soundtrack would have a... you know, make a big noise.
Yeah. Yeah. See, and you had to learn how to shoot, you had to learn how to process, you had to learn how to edit the film.
We're going to make some noise about politics and the media. Some interesting stories from Mike Miller. You're listening to a Jerry Pippin Special. You know, when we pause for a commercial, it's always for somebody who pays the freight, pays the way. Well, I'm going to take time out to talk about somebody who can't pay their way. And that's the stray animals, dogs and cats and other animals, who need your help. And there is a way to help them. Support no-kill animal shelters. It's a gift of life that keeps on giving. These animal shelters are located around the world and maybe in your neighborhood. Animals, they need love. They don't need to be sent someplace and then executed just because they don't have a home. Support the animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter near you. Give them a donation of $10, $25, $50 or more. The money will be well used. The animals will love you for it. So give a gift of love. A gift of life to that stray dog or cat.
Today on Face the Nation, bad just got worse. Now what?
Face the Nation with CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent Bob Schieffer.
Welcome back to our continuing series, Politics and the Press. I'm Jerry Pippin. And we have Mike Miller with us, who's had a great career, a long career, not only in the media as a TV anchor, TV news reporter in Washington, D.C., but also he worked for several people in Washington as a press secretary, a couple of congressmen and one senator. And you worked with Bob Cheever.
Absolutely.
That was at Metro Media, and they had quite a good reputation.
They were the most successful independent station in the country. In 69, when I went up there,
mm-hmm.
And I went to work the same day as Bob Schieffer. He and I both were hired the same day at WTTG, Channel 5, the Metro Media station. And Schieffer told me that day, he says, I'm not going to be here very long. My plan is to go to CBS News as soon as I can get there. And I'd say within 6 months or 8 months, I know what it was, Eisenhower died, and he was anchoring the coverage. Uh-huh. CBS saw him, and that really helped him apply for the job and got it. About the time Bob Gregory, the guy who had hired me a couple of times in Tulsa, was leaving CBS News, so there was an opening there. And Schieffer was there. Connie Chung was hired. She got her first job. Walked into the newsroom. She had just graduated from college. You could imagine how she looked, about 19 years old. And the news director, Mike Buchanan, looked at her and he said, "I don't know who you are or what you can do, but you're hired." And Maury Povich, the guy she's married to, was a sports director there at the time.
Oh, really? A sports guy? I didn't know that. I thought I was thinking current affair was his first job.
He was married to someone else. And I think Connie eventually ended up in Los Angeles.
Yes, she did.
Co-anchoring the news with Maury Povich, and I think that's when
the things happened, right?
Yeah, began. But I ran into Connie. She's something else. She is unpretentious, and she would, I always got Christmas cards from her for years, and I ran into her at a convention, Republican convention in Dallas, I think it was, and I was like a long lost friend, big hug, and I still get a card every Christmas season from Connie and Maury. It's not a Christmas card, it's a season. I think Maury's Jewish,
mm-hmm.
And so the card is not Christmassy, but it's she never forgets. And I always get a card from her.
she's just a very very nice person, and it never went through her head. And Maury was, he was a little bit look down your nose at other people. He was not only the sports director, you know, his father was a sports editor of the Washington Post, Shirley Povich, and he was pretty high and mighty. He had a show called a noon type show for 2 hours, where he and two other people just Panorama, it was called.
That's right. It was used by Metro Media stations everywhere, all across the country. That title, that format.
Yes. And so he, you know, he was, he might have had some complexes, but inferiority wasn't one of them. Put it that way.
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
No, but he was nice to me. You
know. Now, at Metro Media in Washington, D.C., I mean, what was your beat? What did
you
cover?
Well, I covered the Capitol and the White House.
Oh, so you were already into politics. Now, you had this job before you got your first press secretary job, is that right?
Yep, right. Yeah. The press secretary jobs all came about 10 years later when I came back to Washington with Bethune. But all this experience covering politics was very helpful as a press secretary, where you had to deal with the press because you could see their side of everything and you understood their problems. Because a press secretary, you work for the congressman or senator, but you also, you have to, you work for the media too, in a way, because you have to service them. You have to provide them with the information they're seeking and what you help them do.
As long as we're talking about the press secretary job, I still puzzle at why Senator Inhofe, at that time Congressman Inhofe, would let you go. I mean, after all, you had been the anchor on all three television stations in Tulsa, his hometown. He was a U.S. Senator from Oklahoma. You would think you'd put up with a lot just to have somebody of high profile like you were by reputation as the press secretary. I mean, that's just, that's not very smart.
Well, it was just a personality clash, I think. It happens.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, like in Bethune's office, I got along fine with the member, Ed Bethune. It was just his administrative assistant that wanted to go over everything I did with the red pen and mark it all up, and you'd have to type it all over again. You didn't have a computer.
Yeah.
You just had a Selectric, IBM Selectric, and some whiteout.
I think that's kind of the personality of a chief of staff anyway, that they want to micromanage everything, even when the candidate goes to the bathroom.
Yeah, sometimes you have clashes with the chief of staff, the administrative assistant, whatever they call them. There are two types of offices on Capitol Hill, we found. There's the slave shop and the fun shop. And in the fun shop, you know, usually Friday afternoons, they break out the beer and the booze, and you party a lot, and things are relaxed. You certainly get every holiday off, and you work your 8 hours and leave. Then there's a sweatshop, which Bethune's office turned out to be, and thanks to the administrative assistant. And we worked every holiday. We were there Christmas Day, whatever. And
Mike, you just blew the image. Most people, if you asked them, would think that politicians and their staffs don't have to work very hard. It's really not true.
Oh, no, no, no. People really, even in the fun offices, you worked hard. You worked your 8 hours, and you worked hard. It was easier on the Senate side because the staffs are bigger. You have more, the work is divided among more people. And for the most part, I had an assistant when I worked for Senator Hecht, and that was helpful. But, you know.
And, of course, since the senator was from Nevada, you got to go to Las Vegas a lot.
Oh, yeah, that was a big perk. Yeah, a party there.
You were there the whole 6 years.
Yep. And I remember the campaign. People, the media totally ignored him. They didn't do even one. The local media didn't do one single interview with him or cover him at all. It's hard to believe, I know, but it's true. And they just didn't think he had a chance, and I guess they just wrote him off. And then when he won, he kind of made fools out of them, and they were they just either ridiculed him or ignored him after he became senator.
Unfortunately, that's an aspect of media and journalism, really. We're not very proud of it.
Yeah, you get your personal feelings involved.
Mm-hmm.
I remember after he was elected, I went by all the media. I always made a habit of going by and introducing myself and offering, you know, whatever we can do to help, and we have the Library of Congress at your disposal if you need to research something, blah, blah, blah. And at the Las Vegas Sun, their editor, he said immediately off the bat, he said, why did Chick Heck hide out during the campaign? Nobody could find him. And then there were several of his staff in there, newspaper staff in there, and they said, well, you know, we did an interview with him, but we didn't run it. And the editor really apologized. He said, you know, maybe it is our fault. And so things can kind of get out of hand, and images that are not really accurate.
Yeah, that happens, you know, in life.
And prevail.
Sometimes it's not very fair.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've had image problems off and on. And we know I'm a nice guy.
Yeah, right.
Let's get back to Jim Inhofe and his limited thinking. Is that prevalent in your days in Washington, D.C.? Did you, frankly, run across a lot of airheads?
There were a few. I'd say a very small minority. Most of them ended up in scandals. I know there was one member of Congress who had sex on the Capitol steps with his wife, so it was okay, I guess. But it was at night, and he got caught. And that, you know, things like that don't look real good for your reelection chances. Judgment, you know, poor judgment. And then, of course, Wilbur Mills, you know, Bethune replaced Wilbur Mills in Arkansas. And I don't know if you remember how his career ended.
Yes, I do.
He was
in the sort of fountain or something.
The tidal basin.
Yeah.
he was cavorting with
a dancer?
A stripper.
Mm-hmm.
And Fannie Fox, I believe her name was.
Yes, you're right.
He came to our reception after Ed was sworn in, and I was talking to him, and I said, do you have any advice to a fledgling press secretary who's never had this job before? And he said, well, I never had a press secretary. You know, well, I said, don't tell Ed.
Was he bitter?
He didn't seem to be. He apparently had stopped drinking. He was drinking, I believe he said, a quart of whiskey a day. While he was chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, tax writing,
yes,
body, and the story was that he was drunk when all this tax legislation was written, and now, you know, people trying to do their taxes are driven to drink. You know,
that's a good line, Mike. You're full of them today. I'm impressed.
Well, the book is full of them.
Okay, let's talk about the book. It's still available on Amazon, and it's called How High Can I Stoop? It's a great read, 16 or 17 chapters, if I remember.
Oh, yeah. The thing about it is, there's 17 chapters. The thing about the book, I'm not promoting any kind of conservative philosophy. I'm not trying to convert liberals to be conservative. Just because I worked for three conservatives and the National Republican Senatorial Committee, it doesn't influence the way I wrote the book. I was primarily just trying to show the inner workings of working for a member of Congress, how their offices operated, and the funny things that happened. That was the emphasis, was on humor. And I tried to just compile every funny thing that ever happened to me. And there were quite a few.
Well, you not only talk about things in politics that are funny, but you some interesting things in the media. For instance, in Tulsa, you mentioned the TV anchor who was part of an X-rated film. I remember that part, even though I read the book several years ago.
That's right.
And you wouldn't tell me who it was.
Well, let's just, I didn't want to get sued, and I still don't want to get sued. However, back in those days, you had, you know, when we were still processing film.
Film, right.
Of course, it'd be easier, I guess, with videotape. But at the time, if you had access to a camera, a film camera and a processor, all you needed was a female or two, and you had yourself an X-rated movie. And this was done at one of the stations I worked with. And it was a couple of prostitutes that we hired to come perform for us, and we pulled out the film cameras, and they were filmed. And I'll be damned if a couple of weeks later, I get a call from the police chief, Jack Purdy, his secretary. Mike, Jack, I'd like to talk to you, if you don't mind coming over. So I went over there. Talked to Chief Purdy, and he and his top captain closed the door, and they said, started quizzing me about this X-rated film. And I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do here? And Purdy said, I don't care anything about the film. I just want to know if there was a prostitute or two that had been murdered. And he wanted to know if it was the same, if they had appeared in this movie, and I knew they had not, and told him so. And because we had been doing some stories that were rather critical of the police commissioner at the time, the police department was divided, and some of them were siding with Chief Purdy, and some were siding with the police commissioner, and he told me frankly, he said, look, there's people in the vice squad that would like to, they know about your film, and he said, I would destroy it if I were you. And so I was very apprehensive at that moment about it, and found it, and tried to burn it, and it wouldn't burn. But I found a jigsaw back in the area where they made sets and stuff. And cut it up into about a million pieces, put it in a brown paper bag, and threw it off the Arkansas River Bridge. And it's hopefully resting among the fishes.
Yeah, I think I saw it float right by me here in Muskogee.
Could have. It would have some faces on it that everyone would recognize their name. Actually, the girl that was one of the prostitutes that was in the movie was a key witness in a big murder trial that I was covering. Oh, must have been 6 months, 7 months later. And she was on the witness stand, and the defense lawyer turned to her and said, out of the clear blue, did you ever make a pornographic movie? And I thought to myself, she's going to stand up and point to me and say, why don't you ask him? He was there. And I thought, oh, the beads of sweat are breaking out, you know. And fortunately, she just committed perjury, and she said no. And I...
Do you think that lawyer knew something, Mike?
In
other words, it was all over town.
Yeah, it was getting there. But, you know, in those days, people did very risky things that they probably don't do today nearly as much. I remember there was a district judge that, during a murder trial, he called me back to his chambers and during a recess, and he said, Mike, I want to show you something. And he pulled out this big, blown-up picture of a nude woman, and she had signed it, "Thank you, Judge so-and-so, for getting my divorce." And he thought that was funny. You know, stuff like that gets around. It could be the end of a judicial career. And today, and back in there, in those days, you know, 30 years ago or 40 years ago.
You know, Mike, contrary to conventional wisdom, I think it's much more conservative or puritanical today than it was back then. Back then, almost anything went and did.
I think so. You know, in those days, drinking...
almost everybody was drunk.
Everybody was drunk. I worked for one guy. He took me every day out to lunch, and we'd have a tall beer on the way to a restaurant and have three drinks at the restaurant and another beer on the way back to the station, and then I had to produce a newscast. And
yeah.
You kind of got used to all that, but and then some of the photographers were growing marijuana plants right outside the station side entrance, and it was just risky behavior all the way. They were... You remember Gary Busey?
Yes, the actor.
Yeah, he and Mazeppa, Gillard Sartain.
Yeah.
They were working at Channel 8.
Yeah, they hosted a late-night movie series, and it was hilarious.
I was doing the news right before their show came on.
And that was a very, very well-watched
show. Yeah, it was. And
they were stoned, huh?
Well, I think... Busey was. I think Gaylord, he was more of, he liked alcohol better than drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But they would gather, the marijuana smokers would gather in the stock room, storage room, and smoke in there. And then one night there was a fundraising thing going on in the big studio next door. And all the smoke drifted in through the air conditioning system, and things were very kind of shaky.
Yeah, that's the old Channel 8 when Jimmy Lake had it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He was quite a guy. You know, he used to come by on the radio on my show at KBIX every night when we did kind of a variety program, a little talk, a little oldies, a lot of things, a lot of memories. I think he really enjoyed coming by. Of course, I was never accessible to him when it could have done me some good, I guess. But I enjoyed having him come by and tell those stories.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah.
I remember we did a show. He and I were guests.
Yes, that's right.
On one of your shows right before he died.
That's right. And he.
Well, he actually was a pretty good operator. Low budget, but compared to the places I was working...
Yep.
He was he was up there. I mean, if you worked for him, you got paid.
Well, I think some of that money went into his cars, his antique car collection, and he had probably one of the best.
Yes, he did.
And he had a big show once, Saturday.
Yeah, a car show.
Big car show at the Exposition Center out at the fairgrounds.
Yes.
And, of course, Channel 8. It was a Saturday, and of course we covered it like gangbusters, and we were going to close the newscast with about a 5-minute piece on it. And I was anchoring, and I went into the break right before that, I promoted it when we came back. You know, Jimmy Lake's Antique Car Show. And during this commercial break, the director, or the film projectionist said, "I don't have that film. I don't have that piece of film." You talk about panic. I didn't have time to run and look for it
because I'm
stuck in the studio. So I had to apologize and say, due to technical problems, we don't have it. And Lake had retired to his house with a bunch of his friends to watch his own station, which wasn't there. He wasn't real happy. I didn't want to bring that up. Would have probably hurried up his demise, but I think a couple of people were fired over that episode. Fortunately, I wasn't one of them, but it was a horrible feeling to know that this is Jimmy Lake's story, and
his own station can't even get it on air.
Mike, if the audience enjoys these old war stories as much as I do, we got a hell of a show going here.
When I the first job in TV was at Channel 2, and it was the third rated station, and there were reasons for that. They couldn't do anything right. It was just a comedy of errors, and they would play music underneath silent film stories.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that everybody had stopped doing years ago, but they were still doing it. And I remember we had a story about, and I was anchoring then, and we had a story about the Easter pageant in Tulsa, West Tulsa, and we had the film of it. And as I went through there, I told the audio guy, I said, we have an Easter feature on, so we need something appropriate. And I don't remember whether I said Easter pageant or not, but when we saw a film of Christ carrying the cross, we heard, in your Easter bonnet with all the... That was not...
No, not in the heart of the Bible Belt.
Okay.
Especially down in Tulsa, the home of Oral Roberts University.
Oh. So, you know, there were a lot of bad things that would happen when you were anchoring. I remember one time the owner, Harold Stewart, stopped me in the hallway on my way to the studio, and it was like 1 minute of 10, and he's engaging me in some topic that was not of any importance, and I was basically late, and I heard the theme of the news start, and I rushed into the studio, and they had already gone to the set, an empty set, nobody sitting there, and I said, can you tell the director to go to black so I can come in and sit down? He said, I can't tell the director anything, so I had to come in and just sit down and excuse myself for being late. So, anchoring is a whole different ball game from everything else because it's live TV, and just about anything can happen.
And it usually does.
Yes, as you probably know, live radio.
Well, I've had some experience as a TV anchor at a very small station in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Now, I mean, we had lower budgets than you did in Tulsa by far. You guys were big time.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So we learned how to ad-lib pretty well. It was a matter of survival.
Yeah, I can imagine. You've got to learn that or you'll die out there.
Mike Miller, you mentioned Channel 2 in the snafus. Well, they have one popular show. We're listening to the theme, Fantastic Theater. It was on Saturday night, just like Mazeppa was over on Channel 8. That wraps up this segment in our series, Politics in the Press, but we have much more coming up. Mike Miller is our guest. I'm Jerry Piffen. Here is a great getaway idea. Attend the 2011 Paranormal Symposium that's being held this year at the Calchino Lodge in historic, mysterious, and beautiful Taos, New Mexico. The event has a little something for everyone and will be held from October 25 through October 30th. Go to the 2011 Paranormal Symposium website. We have links to it on our websites on the program pages at jerrypippen.com. Or just Google it. This is not just a UFO or paranormal conference, even though there are several major speakers in those fields scheduled. There are many other events, including, for instance, on Saturday night, October 29th, Paul Davids, the well-known Hollywood producer and writer, is screening his new film, The Life After Death Project. It's just one of the many free events planned for this year's Paranormal Symposium and Film Festival. Make your reservations now at aspiefiles.org. Politics and the Media. You probably recognize, if you've been listening to the Jerry Pippen Show over the years, that this is a theme that we use for paranormal shows. And I opened this segment with Mike Miller, because basically we're going to talk about the media and politics and how it works and the people in it, and it's almost like you're in some sort of zone of unreality. Some people say, well, that's true. I'm not sure I'm ready to go that far, but anyway, Mike Miller, do you miss television?
Sometimes I do. I end up watching the news channels on cable news channels mostly, and switching around, and I wonder whatever happened to objectivity. We were always, you know, ingrained in our brain that, you know, try to be fair and present both sides and don't take sides, and that's all changed, and I don't know if I'd be happy. I wouldn't be happy even working for a conservative station, even though I'm a conservative. I just don't think that's what journalism is all about. I think that's something totally different.
I completely agree with you. You know my politics, but I try to be fair and objective and give the other side some time from occasional, every once in a while. People, though, are always shocked. Like, why are you giving him the platform?
Well,
I always felt there was both sides to a story.
If you watch a channel where they just present one view over and over, and they have the same talking points that they repeat them, and they're usually about their enemies, and the same accusations over and over and over and over, and every night it's the same thing. It just seems to me it'd be a lot more interesting if you did have give and take, a little bit of argument from both sides, and some balance to it. I don't know how people can sit there night after night and watch the same thing repeated over and over and over.
Now, in all fairness, part of this is business, and it's because the business expanded. In other words, they used to have 6 or 7 stations. Now you have 50 in a market. And basically, there's only room for a few to really get a big audience. And the conservative audience is loyal. And I was in talk radio doing syndication when this suddenly dawned on stations that they could capture that 13% by being conservative and get rid of moderate and middle-of-the-road guys and liberals like me and just go straight to the choir. And it's worked for them, because you've got 50 stations, you've got 13% of the audience. You can see you probably got more than anybody else in that market.
Yeah, I imagine so. And I guess money enters into it, too.
Well, sure.
Now, the interesting thing is the power of broadcasting, propaganda, advertising, promotion. These stations switched when they weren't necessarily really conservative ideologically themselves, but they listened to this all day on their radio station 24/7. They soon are converted. It's the unintended consequences of the multimedia universe.
Well, I think, you know, we've found over the years, and there's been a lot of years that we've known each other, that we have more in common than you might think.
Yes, we do.
We don't disagree on everything.
And of course, the deal is that, you and I believe in objectivity, and we have the same goals. Maybe we just disagree on what to do to get there.
The bottom line, I think we all want is... is representative government and something that works
for the people
and not for these selfish interests. Just make sure I'm reelected and I have my job, and the most important thing is to raise money, and voting and doing the right thing is way down the list somewhere.
This whole thing, Mike, about how much money it takes to get elected and stay in office, and all the candidates do is think about money, is true. But I really want to put the blame at the doorstep of the media, mainly the broadcasting media, radio and television. As you know, TV is sold by availabilities, In other words, if the Mike Miller 6 o'clock newscast gets four times the audience of the Jerry Pippen radio show, you can get at least four times the rate. And the broadcasters, before 1980, they didn't get a lot of money from politics. It was not a center for income. And now, at most of these major stations and the networks, you find people who specialize in political advertising, period. Even advertising agencies, that's all they do. Because advertising agencies get 15% off the top, and when they're paying a top dollar for a spot...
Yeah, I mean, they finish one campaign, they're reelected, and they immediately start the next day on their next campaign raising money, you know, for that one.
$400 for Mike Miller and $100 for Jerry Pippen, for instance. It doesn't take long to figure out where they're going to spend their money because of their commissions. And so what we've done, and it was attacked and changed because it was unfair, and it was, except for one thing, the unintended consequences are worse. And maybe the Ford Motor Company should pay $400 a spot, but should Tom Coburn or Jerry Pippen running for office? I don't think so. I think we're all Americans, and the democracy angle, the voting angle, is very important.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's the biggest expenditure, no question.
You know, you try to legislate vice, and that's been tried forever. It doesn't work. And money is probably the biggest vice of all, especially if you're a sales manager at a station. You got a big overhead. You got to meet it. Besides that, you got your cabin up there on Grand Lake, Rick's next to James Inhofe, and maybe an airplane, you know?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. The money is corrupting our government, and it just, it's a shame to see it, and I don't know how you can correct it.
I'm not sure you can. It's kind of like the old song, how are you going to keep them down on the farm once they get to the city? You know, once they get the money, hey, it's a good life.
I know. I think both liberals and conservatives would agree on that point, that something needs to be done, but I don't know what the answer is. Maybe term limits, but...
Well, I'm not so sure about term limits. Basically, you need to go where the expense is, and that's broadcasting. And you need to look back in the 50s and 60s. Broadcasters weren't charging an arm and a leg. They had to charge, by law, the lowest rate they've ever charged in that year. And we've seen that before. They kept other rates artificially high because some operators wanted to make some money off of politics. But, got to do something. Maybe just make broadcasters even to the Internet, which will really raise hell with everyone, but maybe make us give some public service time to all the candidates. Then, of course, you got the problem of who gets a free ride. The commission appoints people that can run for office. That's not good. Lots of problems there, but I think we need to limit what the media charges for advertising. I think that would be the answer. One thing we don't want to limit is what we charge for your book. However, it's reasonably priced. And it's a great book, Mike Miller. I would recommend people reading it. How High Can I Stoop?
Just one thing. The book does deal with the drinking, and I found that I was drinking a lot, like a lot of other reporters and people in the business, and they drank on Capitol Hill a lot in the 80s. And that I also fell into a depression, and I found that once I stopped drinking, which was 20 years ago, the depression lifted on its own. It just immediately it lifted. And I think that there is a link between drinking and depression, and it's something the psychiatrists don't tell you. They don't even get into it at all. And I did get an email from a woman who bought the book, and gave it to her son, who was an alcoholic, who had become an alcoholic. And she said, I want to thank you for writing this book because he stopped drinking after reading your book. And that really made me feel good. I mean, this one email kind of made the whole thing worthwhile.
In my opinion, that's another thing that politicians and reporters and journalists and TV anchors have in common, broadcast people in general, is the fact that it's a high-pressure business and drinking is an outlet. And to a certain extent, sex.
Yeah.
So we're in a business where it's wild and crazy on many levels.
Yeah, and I'm sure it was worse, you know, before the Mothers Against Drunk Driving took
over. Oh, it was.
All that. People used to drive around. I remember in Tulsa, everybody drank a beer while they were driving around.
Yeah, they were drunk.
And they drove better than they do today.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, back there in the 60s, drinking and driving was very, very common.
It was. I mean, you'd pop into a 7-Eleven and buy one beer, maybe a tall one, 16 ounce. And that would last you, you know, if you were driving across town.
Yeah, to the next 7-Eleven.
To the next 7-Eleven. Got to keep them cold.
Yeah.
Well, Mike Miller, you're retired and you moved to Florida. Are you enjoying it? Everything going okay?
Yeah, I do exercise. I like to bike ride, and that's the way I kind of try to stay in shape. Ride for an hour every day, and it's Florida's pretty flat, so it's pretty easy to do. And other than that, just take life as it comes.
Mike Miller, it's always a joy talking to you about politics and the media, two of our favorite subjects.
Oh, I hope so. Keep in touch, Jerry. I've really enjoyed talking.
Sometimes we go at it on Facebook. but that's, you know, there's a good challenge in that, and I think a lot of people have lost the spirit of debate.
Right, and still talking to each other.
Yeah, and that's the way it should be.
As you said earlier, compromise has become a dirty word. And that's too bad.
It's not that way with many people.
There's nothing wrong with everyone giving a little and everyone still being happy.
How do you accomplish anything?
Anything, right.
You can't unless each side gives something up to get something. And that's just the way Congress has always worked, and I think it's very unrealistic for people to say it's my way or the highway, and you're going to do it my way, or we're not going to do it any other way.
I wonder if their personal lives are that way.
Probably.
Thanks very much, Mike.
Thank you, Jerry.
Well, they could be, or they could be just the opposite. The wife may tell them what to do every minute of the day. Of course, there's some Tea Party people. Michelle Bachmann's doing pretty well. I don't quite understand it, but she is. Hey, Mike Miller, the book was great. I read it a long time ago, but it's still out at Amazon and other places. And I tell you, people need to read it if they're interested in politics and the media. It's called How High Can I Stoop? Thanks for being on, Mike. I've enjoyed it. This has been a program in our series, Politics and the Media. I'm Jerry Pippin. Until next time, cheers.